Consolidated case numbers 19-3993 and 19-4249. Vicki Linneman et al. Versus Vitamix Corporation et al. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Fitzgerald, you may proceed for the appellants.
Good afternoon,
Your Honor. May it please the court, John Fitzgerald for the appellant, Vitamix. May I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you. In this appeal, we are asking this court to vindicate a fundamental principle. Cases are better decided on reality than on fiction. That is something that this court acknowledged in the Drymax Pampers case. In this case, the district court ignored the coupon redemption rate, awarded a 1.75 multiplier, awarded fees on fees, exceeded the Rubin rates, and awarded post-judgment interest on the fee award. Every single one of those errors inflated the fee award. To put the $3.9 million fee award in perspective, it was $1.5 million more than the value of coupons that will actually be redeemed by class members. It rested on a completely unjustified 1.75 multiplier, and the non-coupon relief left class members worse off than they were before this lawsuit was filed. Before this lawsuit was filed, Vitamix replaced any customer's entire container on demand, and Vitamix found a solution to the seal flecking problem even before this lawsuit was filed. The fee award should therefore be reversed for multiple reasons. First, the district court violated the Class Action Fairness Act by failing to base the portion of the fee award attributable to the coupon relief on the value of coupons that are redeemed by class members.
Mr. Fitzgerald, can I ask you about Section B1 of that statute? Because it says if a proposed settlement in a class action provides for a recovery of coupons to class members and a portion of the coupons is not used to determine the attorney's fee, then the court should use the lodestar method. Why isn't it acceptable for a court to use the lodestar method if it so chooses in its discretion?
Because in this case, Your Honor, a portion of the recovery of the coupons was used to determine the attorney's fee. So the easiest...
Where was that? I'm sorry, maybe I missed it. I thought Judge DeLotte used the lodestar method.
Judge DeLotte did use the lodestar method, but in applying the lodestar method, she expressly talked about the gift card relief and her perception of the value conveyed to class members by the gift card relief. And so the Easy Saver case harmonizes all of these subsections of Section 1712. And here's what Easy Saver said in footnote 12. If attorneys argue for or against a lodestar fee or departure based at all on the benefits of the coupons obtained, then the district court must consider the redemption rate when ruling on their request. So I would interpret B1 to mean you can have a number of cases where a settlement allows for both coupon relief and non-coupon relief, but it might be a case where the fee petition is based only on the non-coupon relief, which is exactly what happened on remand.
So let me give you a situation that would really concern me under your analysis, which is it's a pure coupon case. The attorneys immediately get a settlement for coupon relief. Okay. And the settlement is, I don't know, $100 million for whatever reason. The value of redeemed coupons is estimated at $100 million. The amount they would take out of the common fund would be exorbitant under that versus the lodestar. And so it seems to me a district court has to have discretion, and the statute expressly gives it to them. And your interpretation would say, well, you have to, if you look at the value, which is a good cross check of the lodestar, if you look at the value, then the attorneys would get a total windfall in that situation.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I assume that we're talking about $100 million is the face value, right? And then you have to...
No, the redeemed. However, so you don't count, as you and I both know, the statute says, I think the whole purpose they passed this was the concern that for Drymax is a perfect example where the class got a worthless coupon, in essence. It was for new Pampers and your kids were 20 years old. And so you weren't using, so no one was redeeming them. So it was a worthless settlement. So then the answer there is, well, it redeemed is what matters. And that's, so my point is, let's assume it's 100 million redeemed or 30 million redeemed, whatever you want, but its settlement is immediate. Because both sets of attorneys know that money will come from the common fund. The common fund is what gets hurt versus something else.
Well, Your Honor, in that hypothetical where the redemption value is projected to be $100 million, then a percentage of that is probably going to be about $20 million. I would say in that type of a case, if class counsel really has delivered $100 million to the class, and we're talking not about the face value, but about the redemption value, money in people's pockets, I would say a $20 or $25 million fee might actually be justified. It would actually be considering the amount of value that's actually being put in people's pockets. And again,
right. This is the problem, though, is the common fund gets harmed and no attorneys care, right? Because if it's 100 hours of work, you're giving them an exorbitant rate. And so the cross check works both ways. And that's the brilliance. Well, that's the wisdom of what Congress put in place. I know it's a hard statute to follow, but if this proposed settlement, it gives the district court the discretion to use either method, seems to me, under the specific language of the statute.
And I would disagree, Your Honor, because the statutory language is mandatory. The word is shall. And so it's written in mandatory language. And so I think if Congress had intended to allow courts that type
in
of discretion.
In B1, it's not, right? You're talking about an A.
I'm talking about A and also in C2. And it's really subsection C that applies here. We've got a mixed settlement here, and we've got a fee award that is based both on the coupon relief and on non-coupon relief. So it's subpart C that applies here. And subpart C uses the word shall multiple times. In C1, shall be calculated in accordance with subsection A, which itself uses the word shall. And then C2 also says shall be calculated in accordance with subsection B.
Can I ask you one question? Because you agree every circuit that's looked at this other than the Ninth has gone the other way. And recently the Ninth called into question their own opinion.
Well, the Ninth Circuit didn't. There is a district court decision within the Ninth Circuit that I would say is contrary to controlling authority in the Ninth Circuit.
But well, I thought Judge Friedland did in the Ninth Circuit. She said that the decision appeared wrong to her for a majority of her panel. I guess it was 3-0.
Okay. Well, I know that in the HP Inkjet case, and then that was also vindicated in the Easy Saver case. So I think the Ninth Circuit's position is clear between HP Inkjet and Easy Saver. The contrary circuits are the Seventh Circuit in Southwest and the Eighth Circuit in Galloway. There is an unpublished decision from the Second Circuit in Blessing that doesn't really analyze the issue at all. It just kind of refers to it in passing. So I would say currently there's one circuit on one side and there are two circuits on the other side. And here's what I would say. I think that the position that we are advocating here, the position set forth in HP Inkjet and in Easy Saver, is more consistent with the statutory language, which again uses the word shall in every relevant subsection of Section 1712. And I think it's our position is more consistent with the intent of CAFA. And the whole point here is that fee awards should not be based either on the face value or on some vague notions that a lot of value was conveyed to class members through coupons. If a fee award is going to be justified, either in whole or in part on the basis of coupon relief, you have to consider the redemption rate. You have to consider how much money is actually going to be in class members' pockets at the end of this process. And so that's our interpretation of Section 1712. I think it's more consistent with the language and with the intent.
And can I ask you about the fees on fees real quick? The fees on fees, you the settlement agreement says prosecuting the lawsuit, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And wouldn't you ordinarily look to the complaint to look at the definition of what the lawsuit itself is?
Sure, I would look at the complaints, and I would also look at what actually happened in the lawsuit over the course of the lawsuit between the complaint being filed and the settlement being reached.
But it seems to me that the prayer for relief requests, among other things, attorney's fees. So why wouldn't seeking attorney's fees be prosecuting the lawsuit?
Because those fees were not awarded. They were quantified, but they were not really awarded by the court. They were worked out in a settlement. And as the Supreme Court found in Budinic versus Becton Dickinson, normally a fee dispute is collateral to the merits of a lawsuit. It's collateral to a lawsuit. So I would say here that especially when we're talking about
You have accepted it in the settlement agreement? I mean, couldn't you have noted that and defined what it was? Because ordinarily, when you think of a lawsuit, you think of it from beginning till judgment. And here the fees was part of what the complaint requested. So that would come before judgment.
Well, and a lot of these fees, by the way, were incurred after the complaint was dismissed pursuant to the settlement. So what I would say here is that at the end of the day, we're talking about the interpretation of a contract that has a fee shift provision. And Ohio law is very clear. Those types of agreements are strictly construed. So if there is going to be an award of fees on fees, the burden is really on the party seeking those fees to show that they're authorized.
All right, Mr. Fitzgerald, I've got some questions about the multiplier that was imposed here by the district court. The standard is that the multiplier can be used in rare and exceptional cases. And it appears to me that the district judge did not make a ruling on whether this was a rare and exceptional case. Is that your understanding?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, why would we not remand it to the district court for a ruling on that issue, as opposed to ruling as a matter of law that this is not a rare and exceptional case?
Because I think this court can determine from the record and from the undisputed facts that under no definition is this a rare or exceptional case. It is at best a garden variety product liability lawsuit. If I could just finish this thought.
Please.
Except that there was no claim of personal injury. It settled very quickly, and it was, by any definition, it was not a rare or exceptional case. So for all the reasons stated in our briefs and today, we ask this court to reverse the fee award. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's hear from the plaintiff.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Bill Markovitz on behalf of the plaintiff appellees. The primary benefit that class counsel sought and obtained in this case was a repair benefit. A blender container that would not contaminate.
Mr. Markovitz, I think we both, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'd really like the flip side. I'd like to hear the answer to Judge Griffin's last question.
Absolutely.
Do you mind starting? I'm sorry to do that to you so early, but it just makes sense since your friend on the other side answered it.
Not at all. The answer to the question regarding the multiplier is as follows. First of all, the judge did analyze the factors, the Johnson factors that go into the normal determination of whether a multiplier should be awarded, and found that 6 of 12 of those were positive and focused in particular on the results obtained, which is factor number 8.
And on can I ask you to focus on, so Judge Griffin is quoting the language of Purdue, and I know you may not agree Purdue applies, but assume we say Purdue applies. What is rare and exceptional about this case?
Well, first let me talk about whether Purdue applies, because Purdue v. Kenny versus in the Van Horn case, this court affirmed a district court who took the exact same approach as the district court in this case. And that is acknowledging that Purdue v. Kenny, the rare and exceptional limitation of Purdue v. Kenny, applies in fee shifting and not a non-fee shifting case, but taking it as a cautionary instruction. That's what the district court did in Van Horn. That's what the Sixth Circuit approved. Take it as a cautionary instruction that multipliers are atypical and enhancements should be awarded carefully. And in order to do that, you consider the Johnson factors, which the district court did here.
So are you conceding? I get what you're saying. I totally understand your argument, but you're still not answering Judge Griffin's question, which is just assume for a second we say Purdue applies. What is rare and exceptional about this case that would justify a 1.75?
First of all, did the district judge rule that this was a rare and exceptional case, or did the judge simply skip that step?
The judge did. If you look at R166, her second opinion, her final opinion on the fees, and I believe it's page ID 6969, she talks about the results being exceptional. And prior to that, she discusses all the reasons why she found the results to be exceptional, and that was embodied in her analysis of the Johnson factors.
Okay, so, but does that make it rare? And what's rare and exceptional? The fact that it's exceptional, does it make it rare too, I guess?
I think it's that may be splitting hairs a bit. I think the court... again, look to the Purdue v. Kenny and acknowledge the standard of Purdue v. Kenny, acknowledge okay. that and held that
all
this
right.
case.
If the bottom line, we kind of disagree with you and say there really isn't a ruling on rare and exceptional, would there be any reason why we could not rule on that here on as a court of appeals? Or would that be something that would be within the expertise of the district judge to rule upon?
I would think it would be within the expertise of the district court to rule on, generally speaking.
Is it a factual question? Are there facts involved that would?
Well, there's the analysis. There's the analysis under Purdue v. Kenny of the factors, and in particular, as the Supreme Court has acknowledged, the Johnson factors, and the Sixth Circuit has acknowledged.
But you admit, I mean, so the flip side to that is what you're saying is you put the evidence in front of her. She made a ruling. You won. And so you had the burden. So we've got the evidence in front of us to determine if it's rare and exceptional, correct? What's the purpose of a remand if this has already been done?
Well, the only purpose of it, there is no purpose to the remand if this court accords the district court the substantial deference that the Wilson-Simmons case and others in this from the Sixth Circuit have indicated is appropriate with regard to fee determinations. That is, the district court has a better understanding of the whole litigation process and the course of the case.
I understand that and agree wholeheartedly. I guess my question did you put all the evidence in the record and the district court made findings from that evidence such that we should review the totality of the record and make a judgment call one way or another based on the deference we give a district court?
I think that could be done if this court reviewed the thousands of pages and the entire record. Yes, that could.
All
be
right, done. Counsel. My other concern in this is that it does not appear that the district judge. Well, I think it's clear that the district judge did not apply the community market rule here, but the district judge looked to national rates for class action lawsuits. But that appears to be contrary to the law of our circuit. And how can we affirm this when the district judge appears to have violated our rule of law of looking to the rates in the relevant community as to these cases?
I don't believe it is violative of the law of the circuit. In the McHugh case that we cite, McHugh versus Olympia, this court held that courts can look to national markets, areas of specialization, or any other market they believe is appropriate to fairly compensate attorneys. That's been cited in a number of cases since. That's what the district court did here to a modified extent, recognized that there was a national market, recognized that there is an area of specialization, complex civil litigation, and awarded rates based on that. In the queue, this court found that it was not an abuse of discretion for the district court in that case to have considered national rates as opposed to local rates. And the same would apply here.
All right. So you think that should be the law of our circuit if it's not already, and you don't? Okay.
Your Honor, I believe it is already as stated in the McHugh case.
How do you deal with Haydix?
Haydix in what respect?
They talk about that, and they say the community market rule is the rule of our circuit to encourage competent lawyers within the relevant community. And the only way you can use national rates is if there weren't basically lawyers of reasonable competence within the community, which you all obviously are. You're lawyers of great competence within the community.
These were all Cincinnati attorneys, weren't they, in this case?
These were all local attorneys, yes.
Why would you use national rates when you have competent Cincinnati attorneys? If you try to find a reasonable rate, why wouldn't you look at what they're billing here? I don't understand why you look at the community.
Actually, Your Honor, in terms of what we're billing here, the court cut our rates. We had presented and had requested rates on rates that were approved within the circuit and nationally. In particular, just to take myself as an example, I had a rate approved a few years ago by Judge Sargas in the Williams v. Duke class action and sought the same rate 2 years later in this case. The court cut my rate that had been previously approved within this circuit by over 15% and did a modified rate based on years of experience. The court essentially took the
rule. For example, the affidavit you submitted used Wachtell and Davis Polk as relevant rates. I mean, that seems problematic to me. Those are two of the most expensive law firms in the country.
Our rates fall in line with other rates that have been approved within the circuit cases we cited in our briefs. This is a national case. We are Cincinnati counsel, but like to think of ourselves as a national law firm. We've done a lot of cases around the country. And we requested rates that, again, had been approved by courts both within the Sixth Circuit and outside the Sixth Circuit. The district court
modified. But you agree, even national law firms charge different rates depending on the location they're in. So, for example, Squire Sanders is in Cincinnati. The Cincinnati rates are significantly lower than the New York rates for the same law firm.
Again, I would think that what the district court did here, which was essentially just a minor modification to the Rubin rates, the major modification she made was to recognize years of experience and create another category for 34 to 46 years, which the Rubin rates did not provide.
Okay, counsel, the other problem I have is the only evidence of the reasonable rates were your own affidavits. But it's my understanding you need something more than your own affidavits to establish the reasonableness of your rates. I mean, you disagree with that?
Well, I disagree with the factual premise, Your Honor. We submitted our own affidavits, which showed other rates that we had used, again, in this circuit around the country. Our rates were also supported by the declaration of Professor Jeffrey Miller, who's an expert in attorneys.
Yeah, but that's the one the district court didn't consider, and for good reason, or at least didn't indicate, I thought, in her opinion, she considered. Isn't that the one? I thought Miller was the one who relied on, who I agree is a prominent expert, but on Wachtell and Davis Polk.
Well, he used Wachtell and Davis Polk for a comparison of national firms involved in complex civil litigation. But to get to Judge Griffin's question, was this supported by something other than just the affidavits of counsel? The answer is yes, it was supported by expert testimony. The district court quoted Professor Miller, or quoted one of his articles in her opinion. She didn't
cite the affidavit though, correct?
She did not cite the affidavit, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So Judge Griffin's right that the only thing she considered were your all's affidavits, or at least indicated that she relied upon in reaching her finding.
She relied upon the Rubin rates, she relied upon case law, and she relied upon our affidavits and her knowledge of what took place during the case to determine reasonable rates. Again, these are discretionary determinations. There's a balancing act. She gave and she took away in many instances with regard to the rate lodestar multiplier determination. Your Honor, I'd like to address the CAFA point briefly if I could, because I think there's an important addition to make to the discussion that took place earlier, which is this. Opposing counsel talked about this split in the circuits. And if you look at Newberg on class action, it basically says there's the Ninth Circuit HB inkjet opinion, and then there's every other opinion in the district court or circuit court anywhere, pretty much. But I think in this particular instance, there's no need to consider the conflict or potential conflict in the circuits, because the current case law, as stated in Easy Saver, is consistent with the approach that the district court took in this case. In Easy Saver, counsel quoted a footnote, footnote 12, which talked about if somebody brings up the issue of coupons and says it should be used, then the court should continue consider the redemption rate. That footnote is essentially saying if the court is going to use the dollar value of the coupon. And why I say that is because the footnote is based on the following text in Easy Saver. And this is a more recent Ninth Circuit opinion than inkjet.
Is that the opinion by Judge Friedland?
I believe it is. 906 F3rd 759. Yeah. What it says is, in particular, in a mixed settlement, which this is, a district court may use the lodestar approach provided that it does so without reference to the dollar value of the settlement fund, or of course, it may reference the dollar value of the settlement fund if it accounts for the redemption rate of the coupons in calculating the dollar value. The district court here took the former approach. It used the lodestar approach without referencing the dollar value of the settlement fund. Did it mention the gift cards? Absolutely. It said they provided meaningful relief, but that doesn't automatically mean under any case law that calculation of the redemption rate is required.
How do you deal with your friend's point that B1 isn't as controlling here as C, and that C requires you to use it?
I think the better reading with regard to A, B, and C, A talks about what do you do if you're awarding a contingency? And it says if you're awarding a contingency based on the dollar value, you have to use the redemption rather than the face value. Fine. B1 says you always have the option, even in a coupon case, to use the lodestar method. That's what the language says. That's what the legislative history indicates. C says in a mixed case, you can choose one or the other or use a combination. That's the fair reading. And that's what makes most sense, both in terms of statutory interpretation and in terms of the context in which the legislation arose. I see that my time is up.
Berkovich, if you want to just wrap it up.
The only thing I would add, Your Honor, is again, as I started, the primary repair here was or the primary benefit here was a repair. I would contest the factual narrative that people were better off before the lawsuit was brought. That was considered by the district court, repeatedly rejected, and is contrary to the overwhelming evidence. And I could cite the court to the best references to look at to decide that for yourselves if you so desire.
Judge DeBar, any further questions?
No, thank you.
Mr. Fitzgerald, you've got 3 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first thing I want to mention with respect to footnote 12 of Easy Saver is that class counsel did refer to the face value of the coupons in arguing for the fee petition. At page 679 of the record, class counsel claimed that the settlement had a value of $420 million, and that was calculated by multiplying the $70 face value of the gift cards times 6 million estimated class members. That was class counsel's basis for the fees that they saw. Class counsel even said that the $7.2 million that they initially requested was a mere 1.7% of $420 million. And so faced with these arguments, we believe CAFA absolutely required the district court to consider the redemption rate. I would also like to mention our alternative argument, even if the court disagrees with our interpretation of CAFA. Under these circumstances, the court was presented with the redemption rate, and it was at a minimum, even if we're wrong about CAFA, which I don't think we are, it was at least an abuse of discretion for the district court not to consider that evidence in evaluating the Lodestar award. Of course, one of the most important factors in the Lodestar award is what results were obtained for the class. And by any realistic measure, that has to be based on money that was actually put in class members' pockets. And we know how much money that is. It is a mere $2.4 million. Out of an estimated 6 million class members, only about 30,000 are expected to actually redeem any gift cards. I would also like to disagree with counsel's statement that the primary relief was the blade assembly relief. We know that's not true because the class members have spoken, and by a 2-to-1 margin, they opted for the gift card relief instead of the replacement blade assembly, which, by the way, says a lot about how class members felt about how severe this alleged product defect was. Faced with the opportunity to obtain relief, two-thirds of the class members who bothered to submit a claim asked for a gift card so that they could buy more Vitamix blenders and containers. Only one-third asked for the blade assembly to be replaced. And so absolutely the primary relief here was the gift card relief. The redemption rate absolutely ought to have been considered and merited consideration. And that, by the way, is completely unrebutted in the record. We submitted the affidavit of Mr. Stephen Buffo, an economist, who has projected a 12% redemption rate. And to be clear, that is only 12% of people who file a claim, ask for a gift card, and receive a gift card. It's not 12% of the entire class. And that's unrebutted. There's no other redemption rate that's been identified by class counsel. So for all those reasons, we ask this court to reverse the fee award. Thank you.
Any further questions, Judge Spark?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted, and you may adjourn court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This honorable court is now adjourned.